Yes.
Yeah.
Hello, and welcome to Rietveld Sandberg Research Radio. I'm Laura Duborgel.
I'm Mark Radella.
And I'm Maya Brouwer.
We're very happy that you're listening to the first episode of this podcast.
We start with the inaugural lecture of Flavia Zodan. The lecture was held on the 26th of November, 2024, at the Rietveld Academy on the occasion of the appointment of Flavia as a professor of algorithmic cultures. Her talk, Amorino Latente, Latent Cupid, is about the impossibilities of algorithmic translation.
Before we dive into Flavia's lecture, we will listen to Ruby Hutte. She is the director of the Sandberg Institute and Rietveld Sandberg Research, and will start with an introduction on Flavia Zodan and her appointment as a research professor.
Flavia's lecture was introduced by a particular soundscape that made us curious. We reached out to Flavia with some questions regarding copyrights. That amused her, since she had made the music herself using a couple of AI apps, reinforcing the theme of her lecture. One of the prompts she used was 18th century music.
We now give the floor to Ruby and Flavia and hope you will enjoy it as much as we did.
A very warm welcome to all of you, and thank you for joining on this very special occasion. This evening, I have the great pleasure of introducing the inaugural lecture of Flavia Zodan. This lecture marks Flavia's appointment as Professor, Lector of Algorithmic Cultures. Over the past year, I've come to know Flavia and the myriad of ways that she contributes to research and education at the Gerard Rietveld Academie. What I've seen is someone deeply passionate and dedicated to pushing the boundaries of and in between theory and practice, the academic and the creative. Flavia has led research around artificial intelligence since 2020, which was formalized as the Research Group on Algorithmic Cultures in 2023. Her unique approach can best be described as a critical scavenging of theory, constructing an intricate analysis of algorithmic systems and digital cultures, particularly at the intersection of race, gender, and colonial histories. Her practice extends far beyond traditional research, integrating writing, publishing, sound and time-based media, and public engagement through a wide range of formats. Flavia's work constitutes a very significant contribution to the Gerard Rietveld Academie's mission of fostering a research culture that embraces expansive and interdisciplinary approaches. Flavia is also recognized for her commitment to cultivating a vibrant student research culture. Through her teaching roles across various departments, she supports students to develop their own unique research practices, and in doing so, creates important connections and overlaps between research and education. Flavia does all of this with sensitivity, as well as boldness and flair, and not to mention an exquisite sense of style. And she always acknowledges the importance of doubt and failure as integral parts of research, artistic, or educational processes. In this short time, I've learned so much from Flavia and can now say from experience that she is an incredibly valued, respected, and loved member of the Sandberg-Rietveld community. Her appointment as professor is a clear commitment to recognizing this contribution and supporting research practices that transcend conventional academic boundaries, approaches that don't necessarily follow a recognizable path, but are equally important and necessary in weaving together and offering new perspectives on both theoretical exploration and artistic expression. Flavia, thank you for all that you do, and congratulations. I look forward to working with you on this shared project in the years to come. As we both know, there's still lots to do. But first, your inaugural lecture titled Amorino Latente, Latent Cupid. Please welcome Flavia Zodan.
Thank you. I will start by saying that I've been telling people all day that I was about to throw up because I thought that nobody would show up. So I bear it open so that you know where this comes from. In the print copy of this lecture and the research notes, I dedicated this work to my mother. It is perhaps reductionist to dedicate just this part of the work to her, when in fact none of the work I do would have been possible without her influence. My mother cannot cry due to physiological issues. She does not produce tears. So it is quite fitting that, as sentimental as I am right now crying enough tears for both of us. But when I showed her the print of the publication, she did tell me that she wanted to tear up. So before I begin, I must thank her for her profound influence on my research. My mom barely finished primary school, and she had to work at a shoe factory from the age of 12. And yet, she gave me the plants and the animals, in both metaphorical and material sense. And she gave me this understanding of the world that no art school or theory could have provided. So she is the first person I want to thank for creating the conditions that led me to being here today. And of course, these thanks extend to all the people, human and non-human alike, who make my work possible. This is a rather abbreviated list, since it would be impossible to cover decades of encounters that have shaped me. So rather than take on a Jorge Luis Borges path, recounting every encounter, I would focus on this very specific moment in time. So I'd like to start with thanks to the Gerrit Rietveld Academy and the Sandberg Institute. My gratitude, of course, to Ruby Hütte, Michael Laubert, and Femke Harregraven, without whose influence and without their commitment to me personally, I would not be here. I would like to thank Tom van der Putten, Jürgen Bay, Jaap Vinken, Joyce Droysterheim, Maya Brouwer, Mark Redele, Eva Hohenhout, Anja Groten, Patricia de Vries, Agatha Barr, and of course everyone, past and present students and colleagues at Sandberg Design Department. I would also like to thank Zachary Formwald, Mariana Fernandez Mora, Barbara Fischer and Roche Club, and of course the Slow AI Research Group at Javea, which I have seen you represent today. And Quincy Gario, who I think is around because we've had this trajectory together for so long. And last but not least, I always, always have to thank Roy, Hercules, and Demeter for being my home, because without them, I would have nothing. In July 2024, I am visiting the Uffizi Gallery in Florence, Italy, for the first time. The sheer volume of people, their movements, camera flashes, and endless whispers quickly overwhelm me. I realize that here I am not so much a visitor as a body in a current, swept along by a tide dictating where I look, for how long, and in what sequence. I am struck by the unsettling similarity to doom scrolling, a continuous, frictionless slide through histories, empires, wars, glories, and the mundane, each artifact demanding attention and receiving almost none. The museum as a kind of zoetrope, artworks revolving like frames in a sequence, glimpsed and gone before contemplation can even begin. It takes some time before I can consciously stop and allow the crowd's momentum to pass by. I realize that if I focus on the smaller artifacts, the crowds seem to be less interesting. Eventually, in one of these quieter moments, I find myself standing in front of a small, unassuming sculpture, Amore Dormiente, a 16th century Renaissance carving in black marble of a sleeping child. At first glance, its pose, so peaceful, brings me back to the sight of my dog, Hercules, belly up, legs extended. In this old cherub stillness, I find myself overwhelmed by an unexpected homesickness. Here is a figure that invites lingering, resisting the museum's endless doom-scrolling. Yet, as I look closer, I notice something dissonant. The sign in English reduces it from amore dormiente, literally sleeping love, to the detached sleeping Cupid. I am startled, unsettled by the shift. Cupid, I soon learn, is a translation convention that, while linguistically close, diverges from the spirit of the original, reducing the tenderness of love to an impersonal, mythological figure. At Palazzo Pitti the following day, I felt once more surrendering to the opulence of Renaissance capital, seemingly curated to overwhelm. Works by Rubens, Tintoretto, Veronese, Raphael, each room a visual challenge, a reminder of my own insignificance. See it all if you can. It was here, in the middle of this excessive display, that I found him again, Caravaggio's Amorino Dormiente. Most people pass by without a second glance, but in this dark, fragile figure, I felt the dissonance once again. Was I seeing an innocent child, a symbol of quiet love? Was I in the presence of a little love sleeping, or was I in the presence of a mythological creature? Was Amorino a harmless baby caught in an intimate act, or a mythic god who might strike at any moment? In that subtle shift, a translation that transforms Amorino into Cupid, something essential was lost, an intimate resonance related to little love itself. The warmth in the diminutive Amorino, the quiet affection it evoked, was subsumed by the impersonal, mythic figure of Cupid. This loss felt immediate, visceral, as if a vital link had broken between me and this sleeping child from another time. The dissonance felt familiar, mirroring the flattened intimacy I had experienced with algorithmic chimeras, where translation and transformation had blurred all depth and obscured meaning. The process of converting a written prompt into an image can be viewed as a form of translation, though, as I have discussed in both Haptic Mornings and The Coloniality of the Algorithm, translation is never a neutral process. Just like linguistic translation, where certain words or emotions may be untranslatable across languages, there is inevitably a loss of meaning when an algorithm translates text into an image. Algorithms operate by mapping inputs to outputs through a series of learned patterns, or, as I often note, mathematical operations. Yet they inherently lack the interpretative and emotional subtleties that a human artist might bring to the same creative process. When facing Caravaggio's Amorino Dormiente, I kept wondering which of the two potentials I was experiencing. Was I experiencing the intimate moment of a sleeping little love, a fragile baby in rest, or was I in the presence of a form of deity, the Cupid of tales and myth? I wondered about how the distinctions between Amorino and Cupid in translation faced me with the issue of the untranslatable in art. The shift from Amorino to Cupid perhaps signals a deeper cultural and emotional dislocation in which the full complexity of the original becomes diminished. Similarly, when an algorithm interprets a prompt and produces an image, it often misses the broad interpretative possibilities a human artist instinctively considers, especially in relation to cultural or historical nuances. In this sense, the aesthetic experience is not merely lost, but fundamentally altered. The algorithm lacks the capacity to engage with the untranslability of certain emotions, metaphors, or cultural signifiers that a human artist would intuitively navigate. The resulting image may be visually coherent, but it is stripped of the deeper layers and emotional resonance that are at the heart of a traditional aesthetic experience. Central to this issue is the nature of Amorino as a specifically Italian and distinctly Mediterranean conception of a divine or semi-divine being, imbued with cultural resonances that diverge from the generalized, sanitized Cupid of English-speaking traditions. As I have tried to articulate, Amorino carries an emotional and aesthetic weight that differs significantly from Cupid. The diminutive does not merely denote love, but conveys affection, intimacy, and tenderness, qualities altered or lost when translated as Cupid, which in Anglophone contexts may evoke abstract, commercialized images like those associated with Valentine's Day. Cupid can often feel depersonalized, universalized, and disconnected from the specific Italian context within which Caravaggio painted. My interest in opulence as either a form of political expression or as an aesthetic resistance to neoliberal precarity is not new. I began to wonder then if, in terms of opulence, this translation diminishes the Italian original's emotional richness. In the Baroque tradition, opulence was not just about material luxury, but also about emotional and aesthetic depth, layers of meaning, affect, and resonance. The diminutive Amorino suggests an intimacy that deepens the viewer's connection to the sleeping figure, while Cupid, with its broader classical and mythological associations, situates the figure within a more general, impersonal framework. When considering how these translations are handled algorithmically through metadata used by search engines, image and video generation applications, or museum databases, the issue becomes even more pronounced. Algorithms essentially simplify and reduce meaning in order to categorize and sort data efficiently. This process strips the art of its opulence by flattening its conceptual nuance. Titles like Amorino Dormiente become Cupid sleeping in these databases at the expense of the original's affective power. The algorithm cannot comprehend the semantic richness or the emotional connotations embedded in a diminutive. Instead, it produces a translation that is functionally useful but emotionally impoverished. I began thinking of Amorino in latent space as a node unable to connect affectively to other nodes through intimate connections. I then started prompting image generation apps to create Amorinos and Cupids, but algorithms cannot manage these translations. I soon realized that this reductionist process is a modern extension of the same taxonomies that underpin colonial and scientific systems, including Linnaeus' work, which I have extensively examined in other contexts. The drive towards taxonomy and categorization, whether in botany, art history, or digital culture, frequently reduces complex, multivalent objects to simplified data points. In the case of Caravaggio's work, the translation of Amorino to Cupid is not simply a linguistic shift, but an ontological one, fundamentally altering the nature of the object and its relationship to the viewer. By erasing the cultural specificity and emotional depth implicit in the Italian name, the algorithm transformed the artwork into something it never was, a depersonalized, globally digestible object disconnected from its original culture and emotional framework. Through this process of translation, I started to consider the loss of emotional connection, not only within translation in the literal sense, but also in the manner that digital systems, grounded on capitalist and taxonomical logics, flatten and commodify works of art. The artwork ceases to be an opulent, richly layered cultural product, instead becoming a data point within a system. In this sense, the algorithmic process mirrors the colonizing impulse to classify, control, and make legible a complex, emotional, and often resistant work. In my research, untranslability may extend beyond the linguistical cultural domains into the materiality of the artwork itself. Caravaggio's use of chiaroscuro, the dramatic interplay of light and shadow, creates a visual opulence that is difficult to capture, let alone translate through digital media or algorithmic processes. Digital reproductions of his work fail to capture the depth and texture of his original painting, reducing it to a flattened image on a screen. This contributes further to the loss of emotional connection, as the viewer no longer engages with the material opulence of the original painting, which is itself integral to Baroque art. My exploration of digital chimeras in Haptic Mornings confronted me with the spectral quality of algorithmic processes, where fragments of intention became abstracted, giving rise to what I describe as the never-mades. Created by algorithmic interpretation, these entities exist only in potential, evoking both fascination and a visceral sense of incompleteness. In Florence, this concept of untranslability took on new meaning as I confronted a sense of historical and artistic loss. The impossibility of translating Amorino into Cupid without losing its intimate resonance mirrored the incomplete affect and emotional detachment I encountered in the digital chimeras. Just as the chimeras that I have been created in Haptic Mornings and they inhabit a liminal, ghostly realm, so does Amorino Dormiente become spectral when stripped of its cultural specificity and emotional weight through translation. It is within this framework of aesthetic and emotional loss that I approached Amorino Latente as a continuation of my engagement with how meaning dissipates in the process of interpretation, whether through digital systems or through language. In developing these chimeras, the never-mades, artifacts shaped through algorithmic processes rather than human intent, I found the connection to Marcel Duchamp. Unlike Duchamp's ready-mades, which elevate physical objects through recontextualization, never-mades inhabit a purely digital or potential space, existing at the boundary between the made and the unmade. These entities, born from computational interpretation rather than human intent, embody a spectral presence that challenge traditional categories of reality. They evoke emotional responses, much like physical objects, yet they remain artifacts of potentiality, visible, stirring, and ultimately untouchable. Duchamp's work plays with notions of authorship and the role of the artist, while the never-mades extend this exploration into the digital, questioning the very possibility of being within algorithms. The sense of loss in creating these digital entities parallels the reduction I felt in the translation of Amorino Dormiente, with each filtered through a system that diminishes original richness. In both instances, this richness fades when filtered through an abstracting system, whether through linguistic translation or algorithmic processes. Perhaps my interest lies in how algorithmic affect, that is, the emotional resonance I experience through the never-mades, resembles a broader theme of loss similar to what happens when a work of art undergoes translation. As Amorino transforms into Cupid, this ontological shift mirrors the spectral, emotionally hollow presence of the chimeras. Both processes strip away specificity, leaving something visible but incomplete. These algorithmic outputs, like the translated titles, evoke an emotional response that is incomplete and spectral, never quite reaching the depth of an original. The haunting presence of absence that I have attempted to articulate in connection with the Never Maids can also be applied to the emotional loss experienced in translating Amorino Dormiente. These digital creations act as ghostly apparitions, visible yet lacking the full emotional depth and resonance carried by originals. Just as the rich affective layers of Amorino are lost in its conversion to Cupid, the Never Maids cannot be fully realized, existing as echoes of a possibility that will never fully take shape. In both cases, what remains is a spectral presence, something that exists without ever fully coming into being. Returning to my reflections on touch and haptic visuality, particularly in relation to Laura Umark's work, I find that the lack of tactile engagement in these digital chimeras parallels the emotional and physical disconnection I experience when a work is translated and stripped of depth. The original title evokes an embodied intimacy, a sense of love and closeness that is dulled when translated into another language. In a sense, the haptic quality of Caravaggio's painting, which invites an emotional and tactile connection, becomes less potent when viewed through the impersonal and detached lens of either linguistic translation or computational processes. The themes of mourning and loss in haptic mournings, whether mourning the passing of my cat or the ontological loss of the Never Maids, afforded me a deeper understanding of the experience of loss within algorithmic systems. This is not merely the loss of an object, but a mourning for the relational and affective dimensions that vanish when something is reduced or abstracted. Whether through glitches in an algorithmic process or the flattening effect of the linguistic translation, a profound loss occurs, an unfulfilled emotional presence that lingers as a ghostly reminder of what has been removed. I was moved by the realization that the transition from Amorino Dormiente to Cupid becomes, in this context, a continuation of my exploration of loss, not simply as an affective state, but as an ontological disruption. The transformation mirrors the journey from the made to the never made, from material richness to spectral presence. Through both linguistic and algorithmic translation, opulence and depth are not simply lost. They're systematically stripped away, leaving a hollow reminder of what might never be reclaimed. The aesthetic sublime refers to an experience or quality within art and nature that evokes awe, wonder, or a sense of vastness that transcends ordinary perception. Originating from Edmund Burke and Immanuel Kant's philosophical works, the sublime is characterized by encounters with something overwhelming, immense landscapes, grand architecture, or intense artistic expression that provokes a mix of pleasure and fear, often due to its grandeur or perceived boundlessness. Unlike beauty, which is typically harmonious and contained, the sublime embodies a powerful and often unsettling intensity that transcends conventional boundaries, inviting viewers to confront the limits of comprehension and control. The aesthetic sublime can verge on pathology when these emotions become overpowering. The Stendhal syndrome, also known as the Florence syndrome, describes a psychosomatic reaction characterized by overwhelming feelings, often involving dizziness, fainting, rapid heartbeat, confusion, or even hallucinations triggered by exposure to profound works of art. The term originates from a personal account by the 19th century French author Stendhal, who described experiencing intense emotional distress and a sense of divine ecstasy during his 1817 visit to Florence, particularly while viewing the city's stunning art and architecture. More broadly, the syndrome reflects a deep, almost physical response to beauty and aesthetic intensity, usually triggered by artwork of a certain scale. The syndrome's effects have been described as profound, an experience of the aesthetic sublime connected to the emotional and psychological impact that art can have, one that transcends cognitive understanding. In Florence, I often thought about the Stendhal syndrome, wondering what it might be to experience a bodily response so overwhelming that I could faint in the presence of art. I began to wonder whether an algorithmic sublime was possible while walking on haptic mornings, confronted by these unsettling, beautiful images of chimeras. I began to consider whether an algorithmic sublime could emerge from these never-mades. Would anyone ever experience a form of algorithmic Stendhal syndrome? In trying to define this algorithmic sublime, I was attempting to conceptualize it as an impossible sublime, a form of aesthetic engagement that evokes awe, longing, and even frustration, not through any tangible, remembered, or emotionally grounded experience, but through a computational approximation of desire. This would be a sublime that confronts the viewer with an aspirational reflection of the self, stripped of the imperfections, emotions, and historical depth that make subjective experience real. It is a spectral encounter where the image produced by the algorithm haunts as a fragment of potential that forever eludes grasp. I sense Derrida's hauntology echoing within this potential algorithmic sublime. This concept of the algorithmic sublime that I attempt to articulate somehow aligns with Frederick Jameson's critique of late capitalism, particularly in how it foregrounds an aesthetic of complexity that overwhelms human understanding. Jameson describes late capitalism as characterized by immense systems, financial markets, global networks, and corporate structures that operate beyond the grasp of the individual, fostering a sense of alienation and disorientation. Similarly, this algorithmic sublime offers an aesthetic encounter that resists translation into human terms, reflecting what I started to perceive as a shift towards abstraction and opacity. I was drawn to Jameson's emphasis on the encounter with economic and social systems that function in ways largely hidden from or unintelligible to the average person. These systems, like global finance or supply chains, are driven by logics and imperatives that, though invisible, profoundly shape everyday life. My articulation of the algorithmic sublime attempts to locate echoes of this dynamic in the images or outputs generated by complex, impenetrable code devoid of human agency or direct authorship. In engaging with algorithmic images, the viewer confronts an output generated by a system that resists intuitive interpretation, evoking a sensation similar to Jameson's sense of late capitalist alienation, this profound awareness of systems acting upon us that we can neither fully see or understand. Traditional aesthetics, which Jameson might align with earlier stages of capitalism, are often imbued with subjective presence, inviting emotional engagement with human creators or narratives. My encounter with Caravaggio's Amorino Dormiente drew me into an intimate engagement with its subject, a sleeping figure imbued with tenderness and vulnerability. Amorino invited me to locate myself within a broader narrative. The algorithmic sublime, however, does not offer this resonance. Instead, it evokes a form of awe rooted in complexity that resists emotional interpretation. Like the markets and networks in late capitalism, algorithmic images are computational byproducts that prioritize logic and efficiency over human sentiment, positioning me, the viewer, as a detached observer rather than an emotionally engaged participant. Perhaps the chimeras serve as an unintended critique of late capitalism's abstraction, where emotional engagement is supplanted by an overwhelming sense of scale and intricacy. Following Jameson, I argue that in late capitalism, individuals are reduced to passive spectators of systems they cannot influence or fully comprehend. The algorithmic sublime embodies this passive role by positioning the viewer as a spectator to a computational process that lies beyond their control. The viewer confronts an image generated not by an artist with whom they can identify, but by a mathematical process, experiencing a form of alienation as they realize that the artwork does not invite understanding. Instead, it represents a system that operates on a logic disconnected from individual experience. This alignment with Jameson's critique transforms the sublime encounter into an alienated experience where awe is tinged with helplessness as the viewer stands before a product of technological processes that, like my accidentally made chimeras, remain forever other. If late capitalism disrupts traditional temporalities, creating a sense of perpetual present where historical depth and future orientation collapse, the algorithmic sublime similarly collapses temporality. Algorithmic images are generated instantaneously, existing outside the process of human contemplation or historical accumulation that typically shapes traditional art. This collapse denies the viewer the usual experience of time-bound engagement with art, when an artwork accrues meaning through history. Instead, the algorithmic image arrives fully formed, emphasizing an immediate, depthless experience that mirrors this eternal now of late capitalism. This form of temporality left me disoriented, encountering an object of vast complexity, stripped of the layers of meaning that typically ground a subjective, temporally rich engagement with art. Once again, I faced the affect that the chimeras evoked, seemingly historical creatures with a distinct 18th century aesthetic that never was, living in the eternal now of digital collections. In this eternal now of the algorithmic sublime, images emerge without the temporal scaffolding that usually grounds art and artistic production in general within human experience. These images lack any participation in the gradual process of history, memory, or cultural inscription. Unlike traditional art forms where each piece is embedded in a foundation of historical references, personal intentions or artistic evolutions. Algorithmic images emerged as finished products divorced from the flow of time. This absence of temporal anchoring intensifies their sense of isolation. They are aesthetic objects entirely detached from human perceptions of the passage of time. Encountering such imagery resembles an encounter with a temporal anomaly. The image holds no memory of creation or indication of an origin, leaving the viewer with a kind of non-memory that obstructs any potential for historical engagement. As algorithmic images embody this collapsed temporality, they also evoke hyperreality, a state where representations detach from any stable referent, creating a version of reality that feels more real than reality itself. These outputs might mirror familiar desires or aesthetics, but they are stripped of the imperfections, histories, and emotional complexities that define lived experience. The algorithmic sublime presents a hyper-real aesthetic, offering an aspiration, an ideal, yet they lack the grounding of genuine human presence. In this hyper-real state, the images seem eerily perfect, spectral in their perfection, as though fulfilling a computational vision of desire without engaging any subjective depth. This absence of subjectivity, coupled with algorithms' precise, almost clinical rendering of aesthetic ideals, creates a hollow sense of reality, one where symbols no longer refer to anything substantive, but exist as self-contained entities within this eternal now of algorithmic processes. Furthermore, the implications of this ahistoricity extend to how these images affect viewers' perceptions. Existing in a state of hyperreality, the algorithmic sublime appears paradoxically vivid, yet deeply impersonal. These images are representations stripped bare of the historical contingencies that typically ground and enrich human experiences of art, achieving a state of spectral perfection. They appear to mimic the past, as you can see in my images, but it's a past that never quite existed, and they do so without depth, as they are simulacra crafted within a feedback loop of calculated aesthetic ideals. Here, the eternal now does not merely evoke a collapsed temporality. It imposes a spectral existence onto the images themselves, situating them as hyper-real objects that deny genuine historical or subjective engagement. And here, they intensify the alienation. Late capitalism fosters this paradoxical engagement. It draws individuals into vast interconnected networks while alienating them from any meaningful agency within these structures. The algorithmic sublime evokes a similar response, attracting viewers with the complexity and beauty of its images, yet leaving them distanced from any sense of meaning or origin. This engagement is marked by curiosity laced with frustration, as the viewer perceives the system's capacity to produce aesthetically compelling images while knowing these images lack subjective depth or intent. This engagement mirrors the pleasurable alienation intrinsic to late capitalism, where the system captivates yet remains beyond the personal, offering only superficial access to the inner workings. In the algorithmic sublime, the tensions become palpable. the seduction of complexity without comprehension, the collapse of temporality, and an alienation softened by attraction. By removing subjective agency and grounding aesthetics in computational opacity, algorithmic images embodied this abstraction that is at the heart of the capitalist experience. These images place the viewer in an aesthetic encounter that is both mesmerizing and unsettling, where the system overshadows the individual, complexity outpaces clarity, and the possibility of genuine understanding is replaced by an experience of estrangement within structures that resist resonance. My disorientation at these images is perhaps the form of algorithmic Stendhal syndrome I was trying to find. This longing evoked by AI-generated images embodies a nostalgia not for anything real or remembered, but for a non-existent, impossible past. This kind of false nostalgia triggered an affective response that felt ungrounded, like yearning for a dream or an idealized memory that never occurred. And I go back to the Rida's ontology, where the image becomes spectral, lingering at the edges of comprehension, embodying a past that could have been, but never was. This form of nostalgia complicated my relationship with reality, as I, in a sense, became haunted by an image that evoked the familiar, but offered none of the warmth or emotional richness of true memory. I began to wonder if this nostalgia for the never was lies at the root of Amorino's untranslability. In becoming Cupid, Amorino leaves behind a void, an emptiness created by the loss of intimacy and affect inherent in its diminutive form. For Cupid to emerge, these emotional attachments must be stripped away, a process reflecting the algorithmic act of creation. Once again, I return to Jameson, seeking not so much an answer, but an anchor for my affective dislocation. In The Ancients and the Postmodern, Jameson writes a line that has stayed with me, and I quote, "I hope it is not too outrageous to claim that the body in this sense, I will call it the narrative body rather than the three-dimensional one. The body in this sense only truly emerges in the Baroque period in Caravaggio's old paint." Here, he's not discussing Amorino, but Caravaggio's crucifixion scene. Yet, it is this narrative body that Jameson sees emerging in Caravaggio that was at the heart of my discomfort. This narrative body that is absent in the algorithmic sublime. A narrative body whose existence is an impossibility in the artifacts that I had been creating. I wondered whether this narrative body might be the site for nostalgia, not for the never was that the algorithmic outputs evoked, but for something that has indeed been, a body that in a sense lends materiality to the historical. I speculated that this narrative body would imply a certain weight or density which is absent in algorithmically generated images. Caravaggio's works with the chiaroscuro and expressive physicality communicate an opulence of form and historical meaning, capturing what we might experience as the sedimented layers of a collective memory. In the crucifixion scene that Jameson describes, Caravaggio's figures are not just painted bodies, but humans experience physicality and suffering. This narrative body is not incidental. It is a moment in the artist's own lived experience, cultural symbols, and bodily engagements with his materials. In contrast, the chimeras were inherently detached from any personal or cultural memory. Lacking a personal touch or an artist's material intervention, they could at best simulate a narrative body. They might approximate certain visual qualities, but they could not evoke the embodied historical weight of Caravaggio's figures. Without a lived context, my images felt hollow, even eerie, floating without any anchor in human experience. They might approximate some visual aspects, but they fall short of evoking that embodied historical weight. The frustration I experienced at this encounter with the AI-generated image perhaps hints at the fundamental dissatisfaction within the algorithmic sublime. Initially captivated, I also felt a visceral impulse to reject the chimeras, sensing their artificiality, but unable to dismiss the longing they evoked. This tension, the recognition of artificiality and the simultaneous yearning for the image's impossible promise, left me in a conflicted relationship with the algorithmic output, where desire became a form of haunting. As a mirror, the AI reflected back only fragmented parts of my identity, pieces the system could approximate but never fully capture. It was perhaps this partial reflection that stirred the frustration as I recognized the image's hollowness while feeling captivated by its unfulfilled potential. Perhaps because AI's projection of desire lacks the tactile embodied quality that characterizes human longing, it is only able to evoke a purely visual and conceptual longing that remains intangible. I experienced an absence, a desire that could not be made real. Unlike traditional forms of art that might evoke a longing, the AI output conjured something that exists only in the realm of the hypothetical. This emotional absence accidentally created a sublime that was not uplifting in the traditional sense, but instead it left a void, a missing piece that was both intensely felt and forever unreachable, resulting in an effect that underscored the limitations of AI's attempt to capture human aspiration. Does this opacity suggest detachment from human intervention, transforming the image from an object of aesthetic fulfillment into a confrontation with a system that operates beyond emotion? I speculated whether this shift might either contrast or stand in direct opposition to the transparency and accessibility typically expected from emotionally resonant art. The shift from Florence's grandeur to the dislocation I encountered in the algorithmic sublime revealed a process of replacement, the movement from tangible artistic objects to abstract, non-visual structures that challenged my immediate understanding. While a mountain or a museum like Pitti Palace imposes a physical barrier, the algorithmic process presents an epistemic barrier, a structure so complex that human perception and comprehension struggle to find a foothold. This experience is devoid of accessible narrative or human anchors, which traditionally allow viewers to find meaning or feel connected. The opacity in algorithmic images might suggest an aesthetic experience that evades our affective capacities, leading to a new kind of detachment, the alienation, where awe is replaced by hollow recognition. This type of sublime confronts us with the limits of our own understanding. If algorithmic art serves as a symbol, or perhaps a metonymy, of the computational processes that regulate our lives, it becomes more than an aesthetic experience. Instead, it becomes a political one, implicating the viewer within the opaque and invisible processes of these regulations. Again, I am reminded of Jameson's cognitive mapping, where aesthetic objects serve as tools for understanding our place within vast systemic structures. Could the algorithmic sublime offer a way to see the algorithms that invisibly govern daily life? And if so, does this awareness carry an ethical obligation? It was as if, in a sense, my encounter with Caravaggio's Amorino Dormiente insisted on the human scale, on presence itself. Standing before it, I felt an intimacy embedded in Little Love. The painting, so evocative, resisted the vastness and abstraction of the computational aesthetics, situating me within a world of tangible, embodied connection. It is precisely this scale that algorithmic processes in their abstraction erase. The process of translation I was trying to grapple with, be it linguistic or algorithmic, is not merely a shift in language or computation, but a shift in scale and intimacy. Here, then, is the ontological fracture between the algorithmic and the affective. Where Amorino Dormiente resists abstraction, the algorithmic image indulges in it, subsuming intimacy in favor of universality and legibility. Perhaps it is through this drive towards universality and legibility that I find myself returning to the coloniality of the algorithm, where in that work I attempted to locate the remnants of a classification system that laid the foundations for the colonial enterprise, I now see the ghost of classification systems returning. The drive to universalize the aesthetic experience, the flattening of difference and locality. It is as if these algorithmic outputs reproduce the logics of occupation through an aesthetic. The drive to universalize through algorithmic processes, to render the complex and particular into legible aspirational forms, is, in a way, the recurring ghost of colonial logics, where complexity is reduced and commodified. Yet within this iteration of the colonial gaze, the reflection fails to reveal a coherent self. Instead, it offers a curated version, a mirror of extractivist logic, a fragment of desire stripped of history and individuality. What the algorithm offers back is not a mirror of our complexity, but a deceptive, fragmentary reflection, one that flattens and distorts, a reflection of self in pieces. By presenting a carefully curated, aesthetically pleasing version of what AI thinks we desire, it reflects back a self stripped of individuality, nuance, and history. This reflection is aspirational, but ultimately hollow, an unreliable mirror that fails to account for the messiness and emotional depth that makes one desires complex. Confronted with this altered, unachievable self, the viewer feels both drawn to and repelled by the image, recognizing fragments of personal longing while keenly aware of its artifice. The colonial impulse towards efficiency and bureaucracy also resurfaces in the figure of the professional prompt writer. I find myself drawn to these tips and tricks offered to enhance image generation outputs. The process of translation from language to mathematical operations requires a precision that compels me to classify and reduce each desire to to a single descriptive word. Whereas traditional art production might lean on intuition, the algorithm requires specificity of intent. It insists on a form of existential contemplation, a self-reflective process that brings me face to face with the limits of my own cognition. I must carefully choose my words to achieve the desired output. I am forced into a framework of clear definitions and precise language. Here, the algorithmic sublime reminds me of the Kantian mathematical sublime, the overwhelming infinity of numbers or space, pressing me to confront the finitude of my own cognition. By revealing the gap between what algorithms generate and what I can grasp in terms of language, in terms of translatability itself, algorithmic outputs confront me with a self unable to recognize or influence the workings of the system, producing a cognitive dissonance that leaves me both alienated and humbled. The alienation I was experiencing felt perhaps like mourning the loss of ambiguity. I have always approached my work as open-ended, never intending to find definitive answers, but instead positioning myself at the margins of certainty, rummaging through potentialities. I have always been interested in the possibilities of what could emerge. Often I joke that people with certainties terrify me. And by people, I mean thinkers. And here I was confronted by the algorithmic necessity for precision, which required me to select specific language that minimized interpretative flexibility. This absence of an ambiguity, which has historically been a tool of creation, always allowed me to avoid exhaustive answers, but rather allowed me to make room for the possibilities of further interpretations, memories, or emotions. By comparison, the algorithm insists on a flattened, reductive form of engagement, constraining my subjective interpretation to meet algorithmic legibility. This narrows the imaginative bandwidth, limiting space for any emergent interpretations. Through this self-confrontation, I realized that this precision constrained not only the output of my prompts, but also my self-image within the algorithmic framework. It was as if this confrontation with precision revealed a gap between intention and outcome, alienating me from my own agency. False precision displaced me from a holistic experience of creation, relegating me instead to the role of technician of self-curation, where my expressive potential was subordinating to algorithmic demands. Unlike traditional creation, where ambiguity makes room for an exploration of the unknown or unconscious elements of the self, here I was forced to articulate desires with clinical exactitude, stripping away nuance and reducing my identity to discrete, data-friendly fragments. Throughout this process, the algorithmic self becomes an exercise in existential reduction, where the self is partitioned to fit algorithmic interpretation, leading to a confrontation with a less complex version of my own affective potential. In this, here I found, again, the colonial echo of scientific taxonomies that reduce diverse phenomena to singular, manageable categories, the recurring colonial impulse where language and all meaning is purified of ambiguity to better serve extraction and control. I began to wonder if, in this moment, each prompt becomes an act of self-colonization, compelling me to adhere to a flattened universal language that sacrifices cultural or emotional ambiguity. This imperative to simplify, then, becomes a digital reenactment of the colonial desire to control and categorize, stripping away the richness that ambiguity potentially offers. In this process of stripping away ambiguity and demanding precision, I return to my earlier point. The AI does not produce what it thinks we desire. Rather, it forces us to desire within the boundaries of its language. My encounter with Amorino Dormiente afforded me an open-ended, ambiguous reading. Its softness invited memories, interpretations, and complex associations. Yet, the translation I faced, where Amorino becomes Cupid, reminded me of the algorithmic framework that demands rigid precision, as though filtering selfhood through clinical exactitude. In that sense, Amorino became a mirror where the fullness of emotion and ambiguity could coexist. While the algorithm insists on reducing this fullness into data points, leaving a reflection that feels not only incomplete, but alienated from myself. In this algorithmic mirror, I encounter something uncanny, imbued with a quality of horror, a reflection that feels spectral. Through this encounter, I do not produce these never-mades, the chimeras that have haunted me with their presence. Instead, I continually return to my earlier articulation of the technician of self-curation. Haunted by the absence of complexity and ambiguity, forever choosing the right language, forever attempting to classify my emotions and desires to produce an output that the algorithm can interpret and process. This encounter offers no fullness or resolution, only a fragmented presence, a moment that hints at what I might desire or could be, but never fully realizes it. It is as if the algorithmic sublime manifests as a ghostly echo, a flickering version of selfhood that, rather than grounding me, leaves me an after image of absence. This algorithmic output recalls the hauntology I've been attempting to locate since haptic mornings, a presence defined not by completeness, but by absence and potential that lingers unfulfilled. In this sense, the algorithm offers not a true reflection of self, but rather a reminder of my own limitations. The narrative body that Jameson located in Caravaggio's Crucifixion is perhaps the site of intimacy where the aesthetic within the aesthetic experience. In my own encounter with Amorino Dormiente, I never allowed him to become Cupid. I remained firmly within that space of intimacy afforded by the little love. I resisted this flattening of meaning and linguistic distance that the translation imposed. Instead, I stayed within the potential of Caravaggio's intent, a sleeping toddler caught in a vulnerable moment, a small love rather than a god. The algorithm, by contrast, requires a flattening of these layered responses, narrowing intimacy to a definable output. This absence, this inability to accommodate complexity without resolution, feels like a form of loss. And here is where I mourn for the depth that ambiguity once afforded me. Because ambiguity creates a space where multiple interpretations can coexist, a shared intimacy that is irreducible to algorithmic language. The loss of this ambiguity in translation feels like a kind of severance, as if we are corralled into a forced clarity that prevents the layering of shared meaning, leaving a hollow reflection instead. Through translation, the narrative body is stripped of all that makes it unique, forced into an identity that is not its own, but one imposed by systems intent on regulation and control. My encounter with Amorino revealed something quite profound in my own research work. Through my own refusal of certainties, I realized that ambiguity could be not just a preference, but an ethical stance, a resistance against the flattening impulse. In remaining undefined and anchored by clarity, I preserve a part of selfhood that refuses to be fractured by the algorithmic imperative. If I cannot escape the identities forced by algorithmic processes, my gender, my ethnic background, my immigration status, I can at least embrace the ambiguity of language. Yet the algorithmic sublime confronts me with a mirror that cannot be resisted, a mirror that I cannot fight. This unreliable mirror imposes me fixed, legible identities, reducing the self to narrow categories that cannot capture my experience. At times, I find myself lacking words to express my experiences. In its failure to grasp the ineffable, the algorithm strips away this ambiguity I seek to preserve for myself, leaving only a stark, unyielding certainty that feels more like an erasure than a reflection. I am left to mourn the loss of complexity within algorithmic flattened worlds, a loss that continually returns as a haunting absence, a reminder of the parts of self that evade digital capture. How could I even find words to express the desire to cover Amorino with a warm blanket? How could I express the fleeting urge to embrace this sleeping toddler? How could the algorithm translate these emotions into any meaningful output? This algorithmic sublime becomes a landscape of unresolved echoes, an uncanny reflection haunted by a richness it can never fully comprehend. It should surprise no one when I say that I am in love with the chimeras. They were born from the algorithmic glitches of a system that could not read my prompts. They are, in a literal sense, computational mistakes. Yet, because they were not what I intended, they revealed a strange kind of beauty. When they emerged, I was confronted by the limits of computation against human complexity. I had prompted for taxidermy animals, but the models, untrained in the aesthetic I sought, produced hallucinated approximations, revealing their inability to imagine outside the boundaries of their training. My prompts were untranslatable into mathematical operations, simply because I was asking for something that did not exist. In their emergence, the chimeras exposed the loss of ambiguity within the algorithmic sublime. I love them as visual outputs, and I named them the never-mades. Only upon encountering Amorino did I realize that the mourning I felt for the never-mades was, in fact, a mourning of translation itself, the loss of meaning and ambiguity in assigning elusive others to rigid categories. While I resisted surrendering to the experience of a little love by allowing Cupid to emerge through the linguistic translation, the algorithmic sublime forces us into distinct categories, leaving us yearning for an aesthetic that retains ambiguity and complexity. In this algorithmic sublime, I remain haunted by an absence that I cannot reconcile, a reminder of an opulence that evades digital capture. My confrontation with the untranslatable Amorino persists in the gaps left by the algorithm's unyielding precision, a reminder of what can never be truly translated or categorized. Thank you very much.
We hope that you enjoyed this captivating lecture by Flavia Zodan, our professor of algorithmic cultures. We were thrilled to see such a full house in the Theory Stairs. We look forward to welcoming you again soon, in person or in our next podcast.
Bye!
Bye!
Bye.
Nice!
I
think this one's cool. Probably the best.